Our second case this morning is 2021-800, Robert Bliss et al. Versus Johns Manville et al. For the appellant, Mr. Ashton.
Morning, Madam Chief Justice. May I reserve 3 minutes, please? Chief Justice O'Connor, and may it please the court, following a favorable verdict based on a full record, an appellate court's de novo review of a trial court's decision to deny summary judgment cannot include weighing the evidence against the non-moving party, overlooking evidence, and misapplying legal definitions created by this court. Mr. Bliss was severely injured in a workplace incident, and following that incident, filed an employer intentional tort, a statutory violation of Revised Code Section 2745.01, both subsections A and C. Following discovery, Johns Manville moved for summary judgment, as almost every employer does in an employer intentional tort case. In this instance, the record is a little bit different at summary judgment than would be in the traditional case because the parties had entered into a protective order regarding many of the documents produced by Johns Manville during discovery. Those documents, ostensibly containing some level of trade secrets, we agreed to enter into an order so that anytime those documents were filed, they'd be filed under seal, which is relevant to the court's initial denial of summary judgment. Summary judgment turned on two inquiries, ultimately legal questions, but both heavily influenced by the record facts. Mr. Bliss was injured on a machine, as outlined in the briefs, called a base fiber feeder. Relevant for our discussion today is the existence of a window hatch guard, a plexiglass window through which an operator can watch the plexiglass fibers or the fiberglass fibers moving their way through the machine. Sometimes those fibers block a sensor eye across the conveyor, which causes the machine to shut down. The evidence at the time of summary judgment from Mr. Bliss's testimony was that he was instructed to open that hatch and clear any obstruction with the machine running. Also in the record at the time of the, without powering down the machine being stopped, but the machine still being powered, meaning that once the obstruction is cleared, the machine would resume working. Also in the record was a 2013 incident involving a coworker of Mr. Bliss's who was injured in exactly the same way, on exactly the same machine, following exactly the same company orders. Following that incident, Johns Manville, in an effort to prevent a future incident, bolted that window access guard shut. All the corporate safety documents, which are now part of the record and which were introduced at trial, and which were part of the summary judgment record, reflect the intention of Johns Manville to create an equipment safety guard to prevent a future injury.
How then could the fibers be cleared?
This is an area where expert testimony was relevant, but there were a couple of other ways that hatch could have been guarded, including using an interlock device, whereby that which was present on other aspects of this machine, whereby when the hatch was opened, it would depower the machine such that any of that sort of cleaning work could be done. Upon closing it, it would re-energize the machine and production could continue. The method chosen here by Johns Manville, though less safe, was to, and more time consuming, was ostensibly that the operator would call maintenance, who would come and they would tag out the machine, remove the bolt, the obstruction would be cleared, the bolt would be replaced, the machine would be re-energized.
But I thought you said Mr. Bliss was instructed on how to clean it out, and he did so.
He did.
So how could there be an instruction to do what he did when, because of the prior accident, that hatch was bolted so that you couldn't do that?
This was the first factual dispute that the court identified at summary judgment. Mr. Bliss testified that shortly after the prior incident, those bolts were removed and were sitting on top of the machine, and operation went back to exactly how it was prior to the first incident, and He was still following his instructions to reach into the machine and was injured in exactly the same manner as the first employee. Johns Manville's position was that there are three active lift aprons. If you can imagine, there are two on the machine at any time. There's a third one. These can be swapped out for any number of reasons. That a third one, this third machine, or third lift apron, excuse me, that hadn't been bolted closed was accidentally placed in the spot where the one that was bolted had been. The court identified this as a factual dispute on the issue of deliberate removal. Plaintiff's testimony was that the bolts had been removed. He had told his supervisor, Mr. Culbertson, the bolts had been removed, and he was instructed to continue opening the guard with the machine running. Johns Manville says that was an accident. The other question on summary judgment was whether the bolted hatch guard constituted an equipment safety guard under subsection C of the statute. The controlling decision is from this court's decision in Hewitt, and the relevant language is that an equipment safety guard is a device designed to shield the operator from exposure to or injury by a dangerous aspect of the equipment. We know that it's dangerous inside the equipment, not only from the look of it, it's a spiked conveyor belt pulling threads of fiberglass, but also because a prior employee was injured under exactly the same circumstances. There's no doubt that it's dangerous. There's no doubt that the instruction to defeat the guard is dangerous, and there's no doubt that the decision in the first place to bolt that window shut was for the purpose of creating an equipment safety guard to prevent a future injury. It could not be more in line with this court's articulation of what constitutes an equipment safety guard. Just to touch briefly on deliberate removal, again, both equipment safety guard and deliberate removal are legal questions, but they are highly fact sensitive. And again, the court identified a dispute of fact on whether that removal was deliberate or whether it was accidental.
Counsel, didn't the trial court judge instruct the jury that Manville did remove it, and they are subject to the rebuttable presumption?
Yes, at trial, following the close of both cases and the submission of all the evidence. So our, which is to the point that the trial court made throughout, including in a subsequent November 2019 decision denying Johns Manville's attempt to relitigate summary judgment, that he felt the same fact issues prevented a judgment as a matter of law, but that at the close of evidence, he may be in a position to reevaluate whether or not the as a matter of law, the removal was deliberate or whether it was accidental. So by that point, once he's heard plaintiff's evidence and he's heard the Johns Manville's evidence, court's in a position to rule as a matter of law both that the hatch guard was an equipment safety guard, nothing had changed about that, and now that the fact question on whether the removal, which inarguably occurred, was deliberate as opposed to accidental in nature, and as a result triggered the rebuttable presumption of injurious intent under the statute.
So the appellate court said that the trial court should have struck, I think it was Rennell's, the expert report, and therefore by doing that, summary judgment should have been awarded procedurally. Is that correct?
I believe that's a fair statement of the district court's analysis with respect to, partially with respect to Mr. Rennell, who I would just note briefly has been a machine guarding expert actually in the field for more than 50 years. He's certainly knowledgeable about the types of circumstances which create inevitable injury, and I think his trial testimony, as excerpted in the briefs, is highly relevant on that point. But to the Sixth District's, I believe, mistake in that analysis was to write that the only evidence appellant has of an equipment safety guard being deliberately removed was Mr. Rennell's affidavit, and if that affidavit is stricken, then the case must be dismissed because there's no other evidence. This overlooks all of the evidence relied upon by the trial court, starting at summary judgment, all the way through to the court's post-verdict articulation of both why this hatch guard is constituted an equipment safety guard and why the removal was deliberate removal under the statute. And that was the corporate safety documents from Johns Manville going through an investigation into this incident, an investigation to prevent or plans and protocol put in place to prevent an additional one, the creation of a guard. There are pictures, and we tried to, you know, to show them as best we could. Those PowerPoints they showed call the guard a guard. I've, you know, on some level always felt we were arguing over you know, how many fairies can dance on the head of a pin here, because everyone is calling this guard a guard. And the idea that that wasn't what they intended to create by way of Mr. Rennell's affidavit or anything else, I think is just inapposite to all the facts developed. It's inapposite to the Bureau of Workers' Compensation's Safety Violations Unit investigation that was conducted following the incident. And frankly, it was inapposite to the trial facts, the most important of which, and this is, you know, to the point about the Continental Insurance case and where that fits into our analysis. Short-cutting cases at summary judgment, particularly one here, this is sort of an outlier example where there's not much of a public record, would have prevented the jury from hearing testimony from Johns Manville's environmental and safety and health manager named Steve Hayton. Okay, the jury was told, and it was all relevant, remember, a jury's being asked to determine whether this company wasn't reckless, wasn't negligent, but whether they deliberately intended to injure an employee. They were told various people would come in to testify that this was an accident, they couldn't believe this happened. Not only were those people not called at trial, but Mr. Hayton, when confronted with a document showing the unsecured, unbolted guard, admitted it wasn't an accident. He knew after the first incident and before the second incident involving Mr. Bliss that that guard was unbolted. He knew it. The highest level of safety at Johns Manville knew it, and they did nothing about it.
Counsel, quick, let me shift you. You obtained a verdict under RC 2745.01A and C, and I think the Court of Appeals reversed as to C.
That's correct. We're not clear what happened with the remaining analysis.
What does that mean functionally?
To me, a verdict under the subsection A at a minimum has been untouched. It's never been analyzed. Which is again this, you know, short-circuiting a case, and I understand I'm into my rebuttal time on the. Prior to a full evaluation of the merits, to get to something like deliberate intent is admittedly difficult to do, because so often that's construed rather than as the statute is written about actions, and we can prove and demonstrate actions at summary judgment, but many courts, we believe inappropriately, want state of mind evidence, and simply a denial that we didn't intend to do this at summary judgment can carry the day, when at the same time subsection C, a section all about an employer's actions or inactions, not only would be enough for a verdict, but here enough for a rebuttably presumed injurious intent. So I understand that's sort of a long answer, but technically, no, A hasn't been, the verdict under that has not been analyzed, and we believe it still stands. But absent any additional questions at this time, I'll reserve the remainder. Thank you.
May it please the court. Good morning.
Good morning.
I do want to address the recent question about whether or not the Court of Appeals addressed subsection A under 2745.01 as well as subsection C. A good part of the Court of Appeals opinion obviously dealt with subsection C. And the reason that the Court of Appeals decision dealt primarily with subsection C is that when you look at the trial court summary judgment decision, all the trial court addressed was whether or not there was deliberate removal of an equipment safety guard. And I can get into the flaws in the trial court's decision in a little bit. But that was the primary reason that the trial court then allowed this matter to proceed beyond the summary judgment stage and then ultimately to court, to a trial. The trial court never addressed 2745-01A either.
So does the 01A verdict still stand?
I would say, Your Honor, that it does not. The reason that it does not is, and we have to look at the entire statute and its application. I do believe that the Court of Appeals addressed subsection A later in its opinion, and I believe that it addresses that around paragraph 41 of that opinion when it goes on to talk about how it has addressed subsection C. Now it wants to give some reasoning to what happened under subsection A, because ultimately the question always comes back to whether or not there was specific or deliberate intent to injure. That's what this court has announced, starting probably with Kaminsky, all the way through Pixley and Propak. The ultimate issue is, in order to recover for an intentional tort under this statute, there has to be evidence of deliberate intent by the employer to harm, and that evidence was never present.
What about Rennell's testimony, the expert testimony? Why doesn't that at least create a genuine issue of material fact?
Well, are you talking about Rennell's testimony or his affidavit?
Affidavit.
Okay. I would, with all due respect, the issue before the court obviously is the proposition of law as to whether or not the Court of Appeals had the authority to do what it did, which was to overturn a jury verdict. But the Court of Appeals rejected Rennell. That proposition of law was not taken up by the court. However, what Mr. Rennell did was, Mr. Rennell entered an opinion that was not based on his personal knowledge about the ultimate question for the court. And the ultimate question for the court, which this court has enunciated on more than one occasion, is whether or not under subsection C there was an equipment safety guard, and also whether that equipment safety guard was deliberately removed. Those are questions of law.
But doesn't Evidence Rule 704 allow expert report or expert testimony or expert evidence, even if it goes to the ultimate issue to be decided?
Well, I believe an expert's opinion may be, there might be facts and opinions in an expert's report or even in testimony which may shed some light on the ultimate issue, but what Mr. Rennell did stepped over the line, because he actually gave the opinion whether or not there was deliberate removal of an equipment safety guard. He defined those terms. This was something that the Court of Appeals had addressed on more than one occasion, and in fact had already had several cases in which they rejected Mr. Rennell's opinion on the exact same basis. What he did was he attempted to, and probably did, define what an equipment safety guard was, and then he ultimately gave definition to deliberate removal without having any personal knowledge of what the facts and circumstances were at the Johns Manville plant. So the ultimate question, Your Honors, is whether or not this Court of Appeals had the authority to do what it did. Obviously, Johns Manville is not in a position to appeal a summary judgment decision until after there is a jury verdict, because summary judgment decisions are interlocutory in nature. So obviously, we had to go through the process of trial. Johns Manville moved for directed verdict at the appropriate times during the trial on the same basis as the summary judgment motion. Ultimately, after the verdict, that was Johns Manville's opportunity to file an appeal. And the only question is whether or not the summary judgment decision was one that involved questions of fact or whether it involved questions of law. What the trial court did when Johns Manville...
Isn't it both?
Well, under 2745-01C, you have questions of law. The court has said those are questions of law to determine whether there is an equipment safety guard and whether or not it was deliberately removed. That was the only basis for the trial court's decision. The trial court's decision is probably 2 pages at best. It's a cursory decision. There is absolutely no explanation what evidence that court relied upon to determine whether or not there was, in fact, an equipment safety guard. The only thing that can be reasonably discerned from the court's 2-page decision is that the court relied on the affidavit of Mr. Rennell, because that's all the court cited. And the court cited Mr. Rennell for the ultimate conclusion that there was deliberate removal of an equipment safety guard. The trial court did not define what apparatus was an equipment safety guard. The court did not even go to subsection A, which was the basis for summary judgment, the motion for summary judgment that Johns Manville filed. When Johns Manville filed the motion for summary judgment, it moved under 2745.01A because Johns Manville asserted there is no evidence in this record of intent to injure. The trial court never circled back to that, which is the ultimate question. That is always the ultimate question because this court has announced, as argued previously, you cannot recover under this statute unless there is evidence of intent to injure. And based on the record that the trial court had, at the time it was the deposition of Mr. Bliss, it was the deposition of Steve Hayton, who was the safety supervisor, it was the affidavit of Paul Culbertson, who was a safety manager, I believe. You also had the documents, which Mr. Ashton referred to, the corporate documents. None of those documents, none of that testimony, none of that evidence contained anything that could be remotely construed as intent to injure. And that was the record that the court had before it. Mr. Bliss, at the time that his deposition was taken, speculated about bolts being removed from the access window. But the question for that trial court was, what is the equipment safety guard? Is the equipment safety guard the access window? Is it the bolted access window? Is it the lift apron? What exactly is it? The court never defined it. The court never addressed it. Then, once you move past that, the question is, was it deliberately removed? The evidence that was before the trial court on summary judgment was essentially the same evidence that was revealed during the course of the trial. Because during the course of the trial, especially with regard to subsection C and deliberate removal of an equipment safety guard, all the testimony about the access window, if in fact the access window is the equipment safety guard that we're talking about, and I would note that use of the word guard in the generic sense does not somehow turn a device or a piece of equipment or an apparatus into an equipment safety guard. That is a determination that a court has to make based on the evidence that it has before.
What's a guard if not a safety guard? Why would you call something a guard universally, put it on a machine, it's referred to as a guard. What's it a guard for?
Well, this particular access window, Your Honor?
No, in general.
In general?
You said, you know, it's called a guard, but that doesn't mean it's a guard.
Well, no, I didn't, no, well, I'm sorry. What I said was it's called a guard. That doesn't mean that it fits the definition of equipment safety guard. And I say that because the Supreme Court, this court, has stated specifically what an equipment safety guard is. It's designed, okay, by its design, it is designed to protect the operator from injury or harm.
Okay.
By design.
Right.
That's what it's intended to
and
do.
Bolting it so that it could not be opened without other things happening, the machine shut down, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
You don't think that is the creation of a safety guard?
No, I don't.
What's the purpose then?
The purpose was to make it more difficult, to make it more safe, and there, and I believe, I'm not sure if it was Kaminsky or Hudak, which talked about making things safer and dangerousness, but to make it more difficult for the operator to get in. The process
that- if you make it more difficult for the operator to use it, and use it incorrectly, because you don't want the operator putting their hands in there or whatever, it's an obstruction. So it's,
yes.
It's, and for the purposes of safety, right?
Yes, it is.
So you're saying it's not an equipment safety guard, even though the intent was to create a safer hatch?
That the hatch by its design is not intended to prevent injury. That hatch has multiple purposes. The testimony that came out throughout the trial and in the summary judgment proceedings was that the hatch was designed to look into it and to access it, to open it. When you put the bolts on, yes, that restricts the access into the lift apron. But in order for someone to, and the court has to sort of imagine this and think about the what came out in terms of the facts of the case, in order to actually get to the point of injury requires effort by the operator. The operator not only has to, you know, even if the bolts aren't there, the operator can still get inside. That's what Mr. Bliss testified to, that even with bolts, it wasn't going to stop him from doing what he did. But once you remove the bolts, or if you have an access window without bolts, the operator has to reach deep inside with his hand in order to sustain an injury. The operators had a tool that was used to clear the fiberglass. If you use the tool is not going to cause you to have injury. You have to do something on your own. It's a volitional act that has to be done. And the policy and procedure at Johns Manville, especially after the Caudill accident, the policy and procedure was to utilize the lockout-tagout process. Now, in this case, obviously it's a sort of a comedy of errors, because the facts are, and this came out in summary judgment as well as at trial, it's the same exact evidence. The access window was bolted shut after the Caudill accident. Sometime after it was bolted down, bolts got removed. And during the trial, Steve Hayton added some life to that by saying, yeah, it occurred during a maintenance process. The bolts got removed. Mr. Hayton said he instructed maintenance, bolted back down. But even after that, then the entire device, the lift apron itself, got swapped out with a lift apron that had never been bolted down, one that was exactly as it was designed by the manufacturer, which was to have a free-swinging access window.
And was that just in storage to be brought out and used to replace this for whatever reason?
It was in storage. I wouldn't go so far. It was in storage to be brought out to replace this one in particular. It was a spare part. And it was a spare part that Mr. Hayton, who was the safety supervisor, was unaware of. It occurred again during a maintenance operation, and no one was aware that had occurred. But that was the lift apron that was on the device at the time of the injury. That access window was the one that was on the device at the time of the injury. So that's what was proximate to the injury. And there was never a removal of the access window. That's the point. The access window was never removed. But even assuming that it was, there was no deliberate intent to remove it. Beyond that, there was no deliberate intent.
So you're just saying that the fact that the access window in the replacement apparatus was not bolted was more negligence than intentional putting, forth a dangerous you know, knowing and requiring the operation of a dangerous machine or
Correct.
Machine.
It was clearly negligent. Johns Manville should have known what it had in his inventory, of course. The maintenance and safety should have spoken with one another. There was testimony at the trial that maintenance and safety didn't always communicate with one another. Left hand doesn't talk to the right. But that was all inadvertence. And getting back to your question, Your Honor, about the rebuttable presumption, once the trial court found that there was a rebuttable presumption, then all Johns Manville has to do is produce evidence, not that outweighs what the plaintiff put on, which is what the court put in its jury instruction. It just has to put on evidence that counterbalances that. And the evidence that would counterbalance the presumption is the fact that this whole process, this whole swapping out of the lift aprons, was due to inadvertence. There was nothing malicious. There was nothing intentional. This court has said intent means intent, deliberate or specific. That means the actor meant to do what they did. There's no evidence Johns Manville did that. The witnesses testified unrefuted that it was all due to inadvertence. This was a clumsy situation in which a lift apron got swapped out with an access window that wasn't bolted down, but was according to the manufacturer's specs. It was exactly as it was designed.
But was he told to use it even though it was not bolted down?
The testimony, as I recall it, Your Honor, at trial, was that other operators had instructed Mr. Bliss to do it in this fashion. Steve Hayton, who was—
do it in this fashion?
To open the access window
and reach
it. The way
you did it before it was bolted when the other gentleman was injured.
Right. That was what that's how he had been trained by other operators in the course of his employment at Johns Manville, which extended well before the caudal accident. After the caudal accident, and the court should be mindful, the record reflects this, caudal was disciplined for what he had done. There was no question, and there were safety meetings after this, there was no question that the way that caudal did it was not the way Johns Manville wanted the operators to clear the fiberglass, okay? But Mr. Bliss had said that he was trained by other operators to do this over the course of his employment. It was, you could almost say it was almost habit.
He was trained to do it the same way caudal was trained to do it.
By other operators.
Then caudal gets disciplined for doing it apparently the way he was trained to do it, by Manville.
By other operators.
Okay, they're employees of Manville.
They are employees of Manville, but as the testimony revealed that during the course of the trial, Steve Hayton, who was the safety supervisor, testified that's not something that management wanted done. He was completely unaware when this injury occurred that's how operators had been trained. That came out during the course of discovery and the trial proceedings over the course of the case.
Thank you.
Thank you.
A couple of points in rebuttal. Respectfully, sounds as though counsel for appellee is disregarding the fact that the trial did happen and these factual issues were resolved. A jury did find that Johns Manville deliberately intended to injure Mr. Bliss on these facts. The evidence at trial on deliberate intent, aside from the health and safety manager admitting that he knew the guard was unbolted, was that not only did co-workers reach in because that's the way they were trained to do it, but the supervisor who trained him to do it, there was eyewitness testimony of him coming down.
So you think that amounts to deliberately trying to injure him?
Yes, I agree with the jury on that point.
Their intent was they wanted him to be injured. They tried to injure him.
They took a set of circumstances that they know caused an injury. a prior identical injury, and they deliberately recreated them and deliberately trained these operators to operate in this way. That was the evidence in trial, and that's what the jury why the jury ultimately sided with Mr. Bliss. So yes, the evidence is they deliberately intended to injure Mr. Bliss. That's under subsection A. Importantly, subsection C on guard removal doesn't require a showing of deliberate intent.
But I have a hard time understanding how something that doesn't guard anything couldn't be a guard, right? I mean, this is a panel that someone can look through, someone can use to access, but it doesn't provide, it's not a guard any more than any other casing on the machine is a guard, right?
I disagree. It prevents contact with the dangerous aspect of a machine, which is what guards do.
But any part of the casing of the machine prevents access, right? I mean,
yes, it's that, and that's a type of guarding. Those are barrier guards.
Any part of the casing of the machine is a safety guard.
If it's designed to prevent contact with the dangerous aspect of the machine, it's a guard.
But it wasn't designed. It was. All the testimony was, though, it was designed to allow someone to see in and to allow for access, right?
When unbolted, it could be used safely as an access point when the machine was de-energized, but as is often the case, there's a number of examples of types of guarding, dual hand buttons,
What was the guard? Were the bolts the guard?
The bolted hatch was a guard.
Mr. Ashton, so the bolts weren't in there, correct?
At the time of the incident?
Correct.
Correct.
Yeah. But there were still holes for where the bolts would go, right?
Correct.
Isn't that an indication almost, not even beyond factual, just the fact that there are holes for bolts and the bolts aren't there, can't we even make a legal inference on that?
I would think so. The evidence at trial and the argument accepted by the jury was that the bolts were always a ruse. They were put in to satisfy the OSHA investigation following the first incident and immediately removed.
Thank you. Thank you, gentlemen. We'll take the matter under advisement and you'll be notified of our decision. Marshall, will you call a recess, please?
All rise.